commitments. I can mention what India has said, net zero emissions by the year 2070. Or how about Saudi Arabia making a commitment for net zero emissions by the year 2060, however, with no exit plan? I mean, that sounds so far into the future, and we were under the impression that there's not that much time. Don't you think those commitments are a little bit too far?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is a very rich country that's done very, very well out of oil over many years. And of course, I understand why it's worried about changing it. But if you're going to have a net zero by 2060, you know, that's nearly 40 years away. It's totally unacceptable as a target. Now, it may be that they don't reach it till then, but I do believe that countries have got to set ambitious targets and really make much greater moves. You know, the reason that we are still driving around in petrol-driven cars to the large extent, when 50 years ago they had the technology to build battery vehicles, but they just haven't developed it, is because of the power of the oil industry over the years. The oil industry in the Middle East and the plentiful supply of cheap oil and America, you know, if the amount of investment had gone into alternative forms that went into, for instance, mobile phones, which are now very sophisticated pieces of technology, if the same amount of effort and energy had gone into a more environmentally friendly mass-produced vehicles, we wouldn't all be driving around in petrol-driven vehicles at the moment.
So what are these subsidies? Who gives them out? First, here's John Kerry, the U.S. climate envoy, raising his concerns on climate change.
The statement lays out important steps on CO2 emissions as well, including the need to accelerate using best efforts by all of us to phase down unabated coal in this decade as fast as is achievable.
If he is the U.S. climate representative, he neglects to point out the following fact: that the U.S. government actually subsidized coal, oil, and gas for decades.
So in the draft today, we saw that coal was referenced in the draft, as well as subsidies. That's not good enough. 86% of the emissions trapped in our atmosphere come from oil, gas, and coal. And while we talk about targets and emissions here, these governments, many of them, especially the wealthy nations, are proposing new projects that would take us past 1.5 degrees.
And that is the hypocrisy of it all, which is no surprise that there are protests against this, as seen here.
At the moment, it's insufficient, and we need, you know, world leaders from the richest and most polluting countries to raise their ambition and to provide a, you know, clear mandate for countries to come back to the table next year with more ambitious emission reduction by 2030.
3, 2, 1, go!
One of the things that stood out in this COP26 summit was the presence and action of the activists urging world leaders to act on climate change. They were keen on pointing out the hypocrisy of feeding lies to the general public. Take this group of activists, led by members of the Extinction Rebellion Direct Action Group. They highlighted how the mode of transportation chosen makes a difference, like opting to travel by train rather than air transportation. Another transportation mode that needs reforming is global shipping. There's actually a $1 trillion push to decarbonize it. Freight ships are huge carbon emitters. Therefore, if countries and companies hope to meet Paris Agreement targets, they must change the way freight shipping is managed. The use of electric batteries or alternative fuels is one way to go about this. At present, shipping products across the ocean using freight ships creates more greenhouse gas emissions than the estimated 2 billion U.S. cars and trucks on America's roads, at around 1 billion metric tons. Activists with the group Ocean Rebellion held a theatrical demonstration in COP26 to say that countries need to step up efforts to protect their national waters. They called for greater investment in ocean-based renewable energy, decarbonization of industries, and further research.
So today we have one of our Ocean Rebellion classic theatrical performances, creating conscious pricking imagery to try and help tell the story, which today is on the eve of COP Ocean Day, to draw attention to the delegates that our oceans need to be way up on their agenda. Like, it covers 70% of our ocean and provides 50 to 80% of the oxygen that we breathe. So it's vitally important, and our oceans are at crisis point.
12 years ago, at a United Nations Climate Summit in Copenhagen, rich nations made a significant pledge. They promised to channel $100 billion a year to less wealthy nations by 2020 to help them adapt to climate change and mitigate further rises in temperature. And in another clear case of climate hypocrisy, a climate activist walked toward the British finance minister and asked him about tax breaks and funding for fossil fuel companies. The UK Prime Minister made a pledge with some young pupils at a school to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Here is the first United States Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, with his grand emissions.
The IPCC report and the synthesis report of the NDCs indicate that we have to achieve somewhere in the vicinity of a 45% reduction over the next 10 years.
But the best these two leaders could do was to squeeze this out of Saudi Arabia, a 2060 pledge. That does it for me. Your questions and comments are truly appreciated if you get the time. Just drop us a line.
The COP26 climate summit has ended. More than 190 nations reached a deal, but without an enforcement mechanism. Well, critics are saying the agreement, which calls on governments to strengthen greenhouse gas emission cuts, is going to fall short. So there you go. Another summit which fell short. Well, we've told you about climate pledge hypocrisies, but honestly, here's where the problem lies. We are a consumer-driven society. We use billions of products which have the material produced from these oil companies. Unless we change the way we live and spend our money, things are not going to change. These companies know that, and that is why they will not live up to their commitments to clean energy to the fullest. I mean, really, is that even possible? Something to think about. That does for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. We do appreciate any questions or comments that you can send to us. We always look forward to them. From Mikko Vetäjä, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Richard Ogg, a silver-haired former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, American Fishers Want to Sue Big Oil for Killing Their Trade. But there's a catch. Richard Ogg, a silver-haired former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. But when he heard the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, was suing some of the world's largest oil companies for causing the climate crisis, Richard Ogg took stock of the barrels of diesel oil stacked on his vessel, the 54-foot Karen Jean, and wondered if the litigation was not only a mistake, but hypocritical. How do we run our engines without oil? How do we fish without oil? Electricity? I'm a small vessel, I'm only 68 tons, and my God, I don't know how that would work, said Ogg, who fishes out of Bodega Bay, about 70 miles north of San Francisco, California. The environmental harm brought by rising ocean temperatures has severely undercut fishing seasons and supplies, at a steep cost to the industry. And so, in response to years of setbacks, union leaders pursued a novel strategy to reclaim lost earnings, by going after one of the culprits responsible for driving global temperatures. 3 years ago, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, became the first private organization to join the growing number of lawsuits accusing the oil and gas industry of covering up research that warned about the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The plaintiffs want compensation for damage caused by global heating and to meet the cost of new infrastructure to cope with the climate crisis. They also demand the oil industry change its ways. Richard Ogg is not alone among West Coast fishing boat owners in questioning the association's lawsuit. And the head of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Mike Conroy, knows it. When I first heard of this lawsuit, I had the very same thought. This is ridiculous, Conroy said. Mike Conroy said he understands the lawsuit looks hypocritical to many people because the fishing industry is so dependent on oil. But he said his views shifted when he looked more closely at the actions of the fossil fuel industry, particularly its cover-up of the warnings from its own scientists and its continued efforts to undermine measures to contain global heating. The skepticism among Conroy's members about suing Big Oil reflects sharp divisions in American society about responsibility for the deepening environmental emergency and the challenges litigants face in attempting to hold the industry to account. It's controversial, I get it, Mike Conroy adds. But then I learned that these oil companies were doubling down on these things they knew were bad. And if we're putting forth effort to reduce our impacts on the climate, then we shouldn't be doing that alone. The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, representing about 900 family-owned fishing boats on the Pacific coast, sued after a surge in blooms of toxic algae shut down fishing for Dungeness crab. The crabs are Oregon's most valuable catch, pumping about $75 million a year into the state's economy and account for about one quarter of California's revenues from fishing. In 2013, a huge pool of warm water that became known as the Blob appeared off the Pacific coast. 2 years later, the Blob had grown to more than 2,000 miles long, running from the Mexican border to Alaska. Water temperatures rose to 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 degrees Celsius above normal, causing an increase in the neurotoxin domoic acid that delayed the opening of the 2015 Dungeness crab season along the west coast of the United States by months. The shutdown cost more than $100 million in lost earnings and wages by some estimates. Two-thirds of boats were docked and others had to move to different fisheries. The total catch was only about half of a normal year. I know a number of folks that lost their boats, they lost their homes, they lost their families, said Mike Conroy. Commercial crabbers face shortened seasons again in the following years because toxicity levels remained high and marine heat waves shifted krill closer to the shore, drawing endangered humpback and blue whales into crabbing areas where they are in danger of becoming entangled in fishing lines. In its lawsuit, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations blamed the Blob on global heating caused by the burning of fossil fuels and is seeking compensation for a harmful algal bloom unprecedented in its extent and in its persistence. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study last year concluded that climate change is likely to result in a sharp rise in marine heat waves and a perpetuation of toxic blooms that might otherwise have washed away, with domoic acid hotspots becoming more frequent and more intense. The Dungeness crab season was again delayed last year on parts of the West Coast after new domoic acid hotspots were identified off the coast of Oregon, including near the port of Newport. Clint Funderburg, a member of the Oregon Coast Crab Association who fishes out of Newport, said he was reluctant to pin responsibility for the domoic acid outbreak solely on the climate crisis and therefore the fossil fuel industry. "They were some hard years, but these problems come and go. I'm not saying there isn't climate change, but there's a history of domoic acid on this coast, and I don't know if we can say it's one thing or the other causing it," he said. Richard Ogg does domoic acid testing for the state along a 30-mile stretch of coast in his area. He said the readings are consistently up, but like other fishing, his Pacific coast, he notices that it coincides with an intensification of the vineyard industry. "Climate change definitely is real. We know that, and it is impacting us. But it's really, at times, a cyclical thing. What we're looking at is a combination of a lot of things that are breaking down the system. It's not one thing in particular," he said. Toxic algae blooms have made regular appearances along America's west coast. An outbreak is believed responsible for the Great Bird Frenzy around beachside communities in Santa Cruz, California in 1961, which played a part in shaping Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, The Birds. But the intensity of the recent outbreaks and the scale of the Blob has scientists worried. Studies also show that the ocean is absorbing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, making it more acidic. Among other things, higher acid levels affects the ability of crustaceans to build their shells. In the early 2000s, the increased acidity killed off large numbers of young oysters and mussels unable to form shells. Last year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration the NOAA, released a study that showed that baby Dungeness crabs were being exposed to the same corrosive waters. Still, there remains the question of culpability. "We all use diesel on our boats," said Clint Funderburg. "I'm not going to point the finger just at the oil companies. They sell it, we buy it." The oil and gas industry has spent years deflecting from its central part in global heating, pushing the claim that it is doing no more than selling a legal product and that it is the individual user who bears responsibility for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Four of the companies sued by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, that is Chevron, Exxon, BP, and Shell, are responsible for more than 10% of the world's carbon emissions since 1965. 19 of the 20 largest carbon emitters over the same period were oil and gas producers. But the major polluters have had some success in following the tactic of the tobacco industry and gun makers in seeking to disperse responsibility by putting the onus on individual user rather than the manufacturers. A Guardian opinion poll published in October showed that strategy has paid off, with 31% of the American public saying that individuals are completely or mostly responsible for the climate crisis. For his part, Richard Ogg is fatalistic. "The problem for me is suing. It never seems to solve the problem. The oil companies aren't going to be hurt by a lawsuit. In fact, they want to continue, and they're going to continue," he said. Mike Conroy sees it differently. He says the lawsuit is intended to punish bad behavior and pressure the oil industry into changing its ways. "A lot of my members don't have the time to sit back and actually give this a lot of thought, which is unfortunate. But after the last crab season in California, I think more and more of the fishermen are starting to ask questions that need to be asked," he said.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The competition between the U.S. and its eastern rivals, namely Russia and China, is entering new domains. Washington is set to strengthen its military grip in Africa, a move that's meant to counter Moscow and Beijing's growing influence on the continent. The issue is proposed in a sweeping defense bill that will be debated in Congress as soon as Thursday. If passed, the National Defense Authorization Act will be the first security initiative openly authorized by Congress since the Cold War to funnel military aid to African forces to counter Beijing and Moscow. The proposal lays the new groundwork for a long-term bid to expand U.S. military influence in Africa.
They don't care about development. They may say they want to see this and that, but all their work is on implementing their democracy and their conception of human rights on African nations, and some military support. And rather than seeing the enemy as poverty in Africa, they see the enemy as Russia and China. Very stupid, very foolish, but unfortunately, that's the way United States leaders are thinking right now.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the U.S. But that's a cause for concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in East and West Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of U.S. bases. At least 7 coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under Africa. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claim of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for civilians killed in its airstrikes. The U.S. has failed to provide an accurate tally of the equipment and resources it has sent to U.S.-Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen into the wrong hands. The U.S. military clearly has accountability issues in Africa. The question is, why isn't Washington taking any initiative to improve the economies on the African continent to compete with China and Russia that are already working on several projects there?
In crude terms, either you have your foot on the other guy's throat or he has it on yours. And therefore, rather than seeing the world, the potential for expanding and developing the nations of the world, this Western geopolitical oligarchy says, no, we have to always remain on top. And everything they look at in the world is judged from this diseased geopolitical doctrine, which the British developed several 100 years ago.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa are the lessons from the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
The cost of living in the U.K. surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
There's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market. So, of course, prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
Now, there are two aspects of all of this. The inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. On the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation after Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
The Sudanese military forced Omar al-Bashir out of the presidential post in August 2019. After Bashir's ouster, the military came under mounting pressure by mass street demonstrations demanding civilian rule. The military finally agreed to share power with civilian leaders. The two sides agreed to negotiate a path towards a democratic government. After the agreement, civilians and military leaders formed a joint committee known as the Sovereign Council to run the country together in what appeared to be a transition period before a democratically elected government takes charge. But the two sides were publicly at odds from the very beginning. Military leaders of the Sovereign Council kept demanding their civilian counterparts to replace the cabinet and implement reforms. Civilian leaders dismissed this as an attempt to seize power. Sudan experienced several failed coups since 2019. The country is right now in political turmoil following the military's latest try. Back in October, the military arrested Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his cabinet members and dissolved the government. Is the army trying to keep power, or is it genuinely committed to holding elections as it has promised? Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman Burhan says a vote will be held in July 2023. But Sudanese activists and demonstrators seem not to be buying that pledge. They have held several mass demonstrations calling on the general to cede power immediately. The army has clamped down on the protests in recent weeks, but the demonstrators seem to be undeterred by the bloody crackdown. The crackdown on anti-coup protesters has been getting bloodier. This means that pro-democracy camps and activists are facing an increasingly dangerous struggle. The violent crackdown has triggered international condemnation, with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet describing it as utterly shameful to use live bullets against protesters. The current situation in Sudan is reminiscent of June 2019, before the democratic transition was agreed. That year, the army opened fire on protesters in the capital, Khartoum, killing scores of people. Undaunted by the latest violence, opponents of the coup have now pledged to intensify their protests against the military takeover. The Sudanese Professional Association, which led the popular uprising that toppled Omar al-Bashir, has been a major force against coup leaders. It has called for civil disobedience across Sudan. The African country is on the edge. Popular movements in Sudan have in the past been successful in forcing the generals to limit their involvement in politics. Is that the path the Sudanese people need to take again?
I do think that what we saw in 2019 with the protests were extremely positive in showing the rest of the world what the Sudanese people can do and what the Sudanese masses can do. However, even the Sudanese Communist Party had mentioned how important it was to recognize that the material impact of the protests have not been recognized by the masses themselves. So the poor and working class Sudanese people have not yet seen any of their material needs resolved as a result of the protests. So that's probably the biggest push they're trying to see now, is ensuring that this next government actually does listen to their needs, material needs.
What's making the situation even worse this time is Sudan's economic crisis with high inflation and nationwide shortages of food and fuel. The Sudanese army chief seems to have the final say, at least for now. But he is definitely in no easy position as tensions escalate and people lose their lives in violence. The international community has left little doubt that it disapproves of the developments in Sudan. All eyes are on the army now to see what direction it will choose.
There is no end in sight for the plight of the Rohingya Muslims. Already living in sprawling refugee camps that are said to be one of the most densely populated places on earth, the Muslims in the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar say they are being hunted down by police and local criminal gangs alike. Following the assassination of prominent Rohingya activist Mohibullah in September, the Bangladeshi police have launched a heavy-handed crackdown on the camp residents. The refugees say the law enforcement is using the crackdown as an excuse to treat them aggressively. They allege that the police have blackmailed, extorted, and even sexually assaulted them.
There's no safety and security in the camp. And that is why anyone can come in and commit crimes. And not many people dare enough to make noise in order to talk about the gang activities or any criminal activities because they become the target.
According to a New York Times report, the refugees are being put on a hit list by violent gangs. In less than a month, at least 8 people have reportedly been assassinated by ARSA, a large militant group that is trying to impose its own rule over the displaced Rohingya.
ARSA, the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army. They enter the camp for years, coming in to recruit their troops or coming in and doing other businesses. And also you have drug dealers, drug traffickers who come in and making profit out of the refugees. And you also have other perpetrators who come in, prey on women and children, and human traffickers to abduct people to just sell them to other countries.
The menaces the refugees are facing come on top of the poor living conditions in the overcrowded shelters and inclement weather that's threatening their lives and what's left of their belongings. The United Nations and Bangladesh's government signed a deal in mid-October to work together to aid and serve Rohingya refugees on Basan Char Island in the Bay of Bengal, where more than 19,000 people have been relocated from overcrowded camps near Myanmar's border. According to the UN, the agreement allows the refugees to move back and forth between the island and the main camp in Cox's Bazar. The UN has also noted that moving to the island would be voluntary. Authorities in Bangladesh have announced that another 81,000 refugees would be relocated to the island over the next 3 months. The development comes as most of the Rohingya refugees are not pleased with the relocation and say life on the island is hard for them. The agreement has also marked a shift, as the UN used to criticize the relocation, saying the island was regularly hit by cyclones, heavy monsoon rains, floods, landslides, and other natural hazards, and was not fit for habitation. However, the Bangladeshi government claims that it has spent tens of millions of dollars on the island's development, insisting that it's no longer a vulnerable area.
Those who are in the authority, they've been informed. But then the UNHCR will be saying, oh, that's the Bangladesh government authority and responsibility to take care of the refugee security. But at the same time, you also have the Bangladesh government who is worrying that the Rohingya will be living here forever if they feel safe. They wouldn't want to go anywhere or go back to Burma.
The standards of living haven't changed much for the refugees in the past few years. They were facing murder, rape, and torture at home. The same atrocities are haunting them kilometers away in Bangladesh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my god. These morning scenes are very tragic. I really can't see people crying and moaning. Before I forget, let me tell you one thing. We are going to visit a historical cemetery today. We are going to visit Sefid Shah Cemetery. Sefid Shah Cemetery, which is known as White Cemetery, is located in Behshahr County, Yanesar Division, Sefid Shah Village in Mazandaran Province. This cemetery dates back to 1,200 years ago. Sefid Shah Cemetery was registered in Iran's National Monuments List in 2003. Local people of this region believe that if they bury the dead body of their loved ones in this cemetery, the dead body won't get decomposed after the passage of time. However, it's not a myth, and there are signs of facts and evidence regarding this belief. According to the researchers on this cemetery, there is a considerable amount of lime in the soil, which causes the bodies buried there not to be affected by decomposition. Sefid Shah Cemetery has both upright and cover-shaped headstones. The carvings on the upright headstones are in three types: Eslimi, geometrical, and symbolic. On top of a hill in the cemetery, there are some cover-shaped headstones, which the oldest of them dates back to 896 AH. I am now in Sefid Shah Cemetery. This cemetery is not crowded today and at this time of the day.
Its atmosphere is so mysterious that you might imagine that you have traveled to the past. A cool breeze is blowing, and the sound of the breeze has made an amazing atmosphere. The special feature of the Seficha Cemetery is its upright headstones in the historic part of the cemetery. For your information, these types of headstones are very rare in Iran. On these headstones, the profession and age of the dead person is written. Also, beautiful designs have been carved on many of these headstones. The interesting point about this cemetery is that the gender of dead people are represented in a very special way. For example, if you see a two-edged comb on the headstone, it means that this grave belongs to a man. And if you see a one-edged comb on the headstone, it means that the grave belongs to a woman. And in this part of the cemetery, the graves are so close to each other that it makes walking hard. Oh, something interesting. I am now standing in a part of the cemetery where almost all the graves are old. However, there is a new grave among them. It's a black upright headstone. Looks like a leaf. And on the leaf, there is the picture of an old woman wearing a white scarf with some gray hair showing up in one edge of the scarf. She looks like my deceased aunt. And nothing is written on this headstone. In the middle of the stone, something like a house is carved with a circle inside. And there are bizarre shapes on the edges of the headstone. Well, I don't know what exactly they are. Maybe something like dummies, which are carved very amateurishly. And here there is a huge tree. I'd better get seated beneath its shadow. The silence in this old cemetery is pregnant with meaning.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UK government has announced plans to declare the entirety of Hamas as a terrorist organisation. In a move led by Home Secretary Priti Patel, supporters of the group could face up to 14 years in jail under plans announced on Friday.
Previously, it was just the armed wing of the Palestinian organisation which had been prescribed under the Terrorism Act 2000. However, the new ban will also include the political wing of the group, which currently serves as the democratically elected government in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Following the announcement, criticism came in thick and fast online. Patel's close relationship with Israel was one of the main points raised.
It's not really a surprise, considering where this prescribing is coming from. Look at the UK. Look at the UK. It's an imperial power that refuses to acknowledge the damage caused by its empire's past. You know, how many countries have had to struggle against the United Kingdom for their own independence? So it's no shock that this prescribing statement is coming from the UK government, and it's no shock that it's coming from this current Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who, do not forget, once tried to give international aid money to Israel's army.
Why such a thing will happen? And the only sort of explanation is when you look at the Home Secretary's history, that she actually undermines the procedures and policies of British government, her own country, and had a secret meetings with the then Prime Minister Netanyahu, and she was removed because of that. So she has actually shown she's more willing to do things against British interests and in British policy in support of the State of Israel.
Israel welcomed the move as a significant decision, while Hamas accused the UK of supporting the aggressors at the expense of the victims. But the move would require approval by Parliament first. A prescription order has been introduced, with debates and a vote expected to follow. If passed, the law will come into force on November the 26th. Robert Carter, London.
Justice system in the U.S. in the spotlight after a Wisconsin court cleared homicide charges against white teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. He was in court over his fatal shooting of two men and injuring another during anti-racism protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August 2020. The court ruled that Rittenhouse had acted in self-defense. It rejected the argument of prosecutors accusing the 18-year-old of provoking violence during the Kenosha rallies.
It's been a long day. It's been a long 3 weeks. We're very happy with the verdict. We're happy that the jury took the time, put in an incredible amount of effort.
Gun rights supporters welcomed the verdict, too. Former President Donald Trump also congratulated Rittenhouse and defended the shooting as self-defense. Republican lawmakers were happy, too, with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson saying justice has been served. But others do not think so. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, a Democrat, believes to call the verdict a miscarriage of justice is an understatement. And the victims' friends say they are sad about what the system has done.
Like I said, not surprised at what happened here today, but I am heartbroken.
Several civil rights and racial justice groups denounced the verdict as a travesty. The American Civil Liberties Union says the trial highlights an urgent need for reforms to both police and the legal system.
and gun control advocates warn the verdict could inspire a new wave of armed vigilantism. President Joe Biden, reacting to the verdict, says it leaves many Americans, including himself, feeling angry and concerned. But the jury has spoken.
I stand by what the jury has concluded. The jury system works, and we have to abide by it.
Biden wants everybody to be peaceful as people fill the streets across the U.S. to protest what they see as the failure of the justice system. Unrest broke out in some locations. Commentator Kyla Papuche says Rittenhouse's case shows increasing polarization in the U.S. and eroding trust in the government there.
It is also a foreshadowing of the deep division, the polarization that is increasing and getting worse in the United States. There is more growing apathy, distrust, and zero confidence in every facet of the state and the United States government, not just the judicial system.
Rittenhouse has also reignited debate about gun rights and the boundaries of self-defense in the U.S. As critics remain unconvinced and people are on the streets, the standoff over the American gun culture, racism, and vigilantism appears far from over.
Tens of thousands take to the streets of the Austrian capital ahead of the nation's fourth general lockdown, affecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike.
This is just one of several rallies taking place across the city just the day after the government announced that vaccinations will become mandatory from February.
Around 2 million of the country's 9 million residents have refused to get vaccinated.
I've not been vaccinated, and I believe this is a bluff on the part of the government. They want to put people under pressure. When vaccination becomes mandatory, I will stay at home. I believe everyone should be able to make their own choice.
I'm here because I'm against the vaccination for everybody. I want to decide myself. It's my body, and so I don't want to tell anyone to me that I have to go to vaccination.
The federal government has blamed the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPO, for fueling public anger at a time of national crisis. Police forces confirmed that right-wing extremists, including convicted neo-Nazis, had taken part in the rallies, which remained largely peaceful, despite several instances of clashes and arrests. Austria is now reporting well over 15,000 new infections a day, with the total death toll almost reaching 12,000 people. Health experts say without compulsory vaccinations, the country would only stumble into new lockdowns every 3 or 4 months. Homolezki, Vienna.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on 6 Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American